You're listening to Blockchain for Beginners, the place where we blend education about Web3 with mind-opening conversation.
Welcome back to Blockchain for Beginners podcast. We're back on our weekly uploads. Today, I'm talking to Elena Dogan. She's currently a copywriter at Vayner3, which used to be Vayner NFT, and she does a weekly audio session on Twitter with Rarible, and she has her own newsletter, which she has written for over a year, called NF Times. She is a graduate of NYU Gallatin, where she studied technology ethics and user design. And so we got into, you know, all of the ethics around Web3, building communities, data privacy, engagement farming, you know, playing with people's emotions through social media, all of that kind of stuff. We dove headfirst into all of the ethics surrounding Web3 and really what we're hoping for, what we hope the future would look like. So this was an amazing, amazing episode. Without further ado, here is the episode. Welcome, Elena, to the podcast. I am super excited to have you on and talk to you today. I wanted to start by asking you like a general question. How did you get into the NFT and Web3 space? I know everybody kind of has a different story.
Yeah, I mean, I think that story for everyone, it's so interesting to hear. It doesn't really get old. How I got into the space was my education is with technology ethics. So I've always been so passionate about tech and the problems that we see in Web2. So I really started to dive into philosophy and psychology and understanding technology ethics. And from that, I actually came across crypto. And instead of going the academic route on how we can resolve some of these issues that we have in Web2, I wanted to see if there are solutions for the problems that we see in Web2. And that's kind of my journey, how my journey started with Web3. And yeah, it's been so fun so far.
Yeah, that's really awesome because like something that I keep hearing, and I forget who I heard it from, was that there's a lot of people who will think about like the issue and they'll like complain about all the issues, but there's like a select group of people that'll actually try to say, how can we solve this or how can we come up with solutions? So it's kind of cool that you kind of got into, you know, Web3 by wanting to kind of find solutions for different issues that we face today.
Yeah, I think there are so many problems that unfortunately, we don't really talk about in Web3, but I really think it's so critical, especially at this point when Web3 is still in its infancy and we have no, you know, a still definition of what Web3 is going to look like, to be able to have these discussions and not repeating the problems that Web2 has right now is so important for me.
So can you maybe talk a bit about like what problems do you see in Web2 that you don't want to bring into Web3?
Yeah, sure. I think one of the main issues is data privacy, of course. Data is, you know, more valuable than oil at this point. And these Web2 companies have so much data on us because everything we do on these platforms are watched, recorded, and our data is stored to be sold to private advertisers who will then use this data to sell us more products. So platforms themselves also use our data to give us the perfect mixture of content depending on what they think that we should see. But that doesn't really translate into what is going to make us happen, because these tech platforms, what they're trying to show us is with the aim of just keeping us on the platform more and more. So usually what keeps us on a platform is content that creates emotional response, like fear or jealousy or you know, usually negative feelings also create more engagement, unfortunately, which is why our whole content online is skewed towards negative content, negative news. So this content cocktail is not aim to make us happy. It aims to fulfill the algorithm's definition of success for this platform, which is that it has three different success definitions. One is growth, one is advertising money, and other is engagement. So as long as our reaction fulfills this success definition of the algorithm of these Web3 platforms, it's good. But it doesn't really serve us. And this is like one of the very, you know, basic, this is one of like the main problems of Web2, but, you know, we can also talk about psychological effect it has on kids, especially young girls, or echo chambers, which is kind of related to fake news and you know, very polarized nature of our world right now.
Do you think that, so one of the things that people say when usually people bring up like data privacy is that, well, they don't really care about me, or why do they care about my data? I'm just one person. But when you look at it, it's like if they can get a pool of data, they now have like a collection of data, and they can do like predictability algorithms and things like that. And so do you think that as individuals, we actually do have kind of like a moral obligation to learn about data privacy? Because that's the only way that it's going to change is like by person to person? Or what would you actually say to that argument of, it's just, I'm just me, why would they care about my data?
I think it's a fair point that people feel. But essentially, I think you would still want to have ownership of your data, right? At the end, it's better to have ownership of your data than not, because I don't think, because it's so intangible and kind of difficult to even conceptualize, you know, how much data can they have? Like, what do they even know? But actually, a friend of mine downloaded his data. It was a long process. He's a computer scientist, so from Google, and it was about 40 gigabytes of data. And Google actually had his location updated every 30 seconds for maybe the last 5-10 years. Which is crazy, right? Like how much you can actually learn from that. And, you know, actually like these tech platforms know when we're going to break up before we do, if someone's pregnant that before they do, because these AI are so powerful. And if they only maybe knew about our data, it could have been less valuable, but being able to compare and synthesized using all our data, it's at the end very important, because that's how they became billion-dollar companies. And here we can stop and say, maybe I want a share of that as well. You can imagine a platform or a way of dealing with this data in a sense that you own your data, and perhaps that you still want recommended ads or, you know, a curated feed, because that's, you know, a convenience of our age right now, that you want things curated for ourselves. I don't think we want to let go of that fully. So you could imagine a scenario where instead of these platforms owning your data, you own it, but you can lend it or create peer-to-peer programs where they can utilize something from your data while not owning, or you would be able to track your data and how it's being used, perhaps which advertisers it's being sold to, and how that data comes back to you in the form of advertisements. So you can have a more knowledgeable and proper understanding and relationship with your own data and your own relationship with how you use these platforms. So there is no one simple solution on how Web2 problems can be resolved with Web3, but I think there are a lot of technological possibilities that we need to talk about, because perhaps there are different solutions that would be better for us.
Yeah, so the way that when you were explaining it, I kind of thought of like a valve almost, like so the person whose data it is gets to turn the valve on and off when they choose, essentially. Maybe with their data?
About what? You cut off for a second, sorry.
Like, as an example, maybe for somebody that, like when you were talking about the owner of data getting to choose, I picture like a valve in my head, like, you know, when you're turning like water on and off, like you would get to check, yes, I want my data shared there. I'm turning the valve on, or I'm going to turn the valve off and like stop the water from flowing.
Yeah. Yeah,
I don't
definitely.
Know why I thought of that.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I mean, at the end, who has the power to turn it on and off, right? You would want to have that power at the end. At least have that decision. Or, you know, Apple's new privacy settings let you ask app not to track your data. But essentially, I mean, that's a step in the right direction, but it's still a solution offered to us from a Web2 company, essentially for its own sake, even though it's good for the users. So, you know, perhaps some sort of regulatory approach or a request from the users, I think, would be more powerful in creating this change.
Yeah, so like a user-forward kind of mentality as opposed to kind of giving power over to the people that have created systems previously. I had a question, more like a psychological question. I was talking to somebody the other day about knowledge. It was Michael Foucault, who was a psychologist or a philosopher. And he had said something about, like, if knowledge is power, like, knowledge, it can't be just about power because they exist separately. So they can coexist, but they exist separately as well. And he said, if you have knowledge, then you have control. And if you have control, then you have power. And the individual that I was talking to said, you have to be careful who you share your information with, because knowledge can be a weapon. And we were kind of talking about like Web3, blockchain technology. And I realized that with that kind of thinking, you are putting yourself in the position of power, because you can choose who you're giving knowledge to or not. So, like, do you think that what we talk about with decentralization also comes down to like the way that we individually think, that we think as individuals? Like, we could have like a centralized mentality or a decentralized mentality, if that makes sense.
I agree. I think education leads to learning more and having more knowledge. And I think it's always very valuable the more you know on a topic that affects you or that you're interested in. So in this case, of course, the knowledge and interest around data privacy and visibility increased with first the Cambridge Analytica situation with Facebook, and then later this last year with Frances Haugen leaking documents from Meta. We have more information, which gives us more power and gives regulatory actors more power to act on these issues. And I think that even connects to us or the governments asking for more data from the companies themselves as well. They shouldn't be self-regulatory, as they are the largest companies in the history of the world. So, you know, Facebook has a oversight board that is semi, it's supposed to be not connected, but it definitely is. You know, have actors within the company itself. And we can't trust Facebook's own board to make sure that they make decisions that are for us.
Yeah. Do you think that it also leads into talks about social credit scores? Because there's two sides to it that I always hear people talk about, is like wanting to incentivize people to you know, not have online bullying and to, you know, kind of cease the scam part of like what we see in Web3. But also my question for that would be like, who gets to create the score and like, how does that score change over time? I can see kind of like people are concerned about that just from what I see on Twitter, when they're talking about having one space for all of your social content to come to, which of course that's like your domain, that's your identity. And I don't think that you necessarily have to have your real name out in the world. But there's also like a lot of concern from what I see in that direction of who's actually scoring if we were to have this one stop shop and it is attached to like an online score of some sort of how you behave. Do you have any concerns about that?
Yeah, I don't think that's a good idea at all. It reminds me of Black Mirror. The nosedive episode. I don't think we should do anything of those sorts because, I mean, ranking people is never good. It's never appropriate, I don't believe. It has so many layers and so many... Internet has so many different workings and cultures and communities, and it enabled people to find one another in a way that was not possible before. So that's why, you know, you find the weirdest conspiracy theories, because if you were living in a random town and if you believed the earth was flat, and then you wouldn't be able to find someone else who would think the same. But you go onto Facebook and you type flat earth, and then you find 100,000 people who believe the same thing that you do. So in that sense, I'm not sure that that's a good idea. And I am concerned about that. If anything, I think there's perhaps some value in rewarding and incentivizing good behavior. An example that I always had in mind, which was part of a project that I was working in 2019. I was working in a blockchain company called Threefold Foundation, and they are building a layer zero peer-to-peer internet. And our idea was, how can you imagine an app that interacts with people? Like, how can users interact with blockchain? And then we were kind of imagining a feed, a social feed, and how a social media platform could look on Web3. And we really tried to create incentives that were positive instead of the current algorithm trying to keep people more on the platform. And we could imagine one of our ideas was perhaps incentivize and showcase events where you actually meet face-to-face. So you incentivize meeting in real life rather than talking on the phone. Or you can create events that is more geared, maybe you clean the ocean instead of, you know, going and meeting for some other nefarious purpose. So I think there are things that we could create and different ways of imagining tech, because it's basically the new iteration of internet. We are on the frontiers of it, and Web2 grew to be this giant beast. So how can we make sure to imagine internet? Because it can be anything, basically. The tools are there. Blockchain gives us even more tools to create with. So how can we make the best internet possible for the most number of people?
Yeah, that's definitely something that... Yeah, I don't have any answers right now. Like, that would take so much time to actually think about doing it correctly. And I can only say from where I'm sitting, like, I hope that there are people out there that are actively thinking about that and then working towards making something positive. Yeah, but there's so much... I guess it does come down to, like, there's so many, I guess, ethical concerns. I think because when I was thinking about that, like, you know, social credit score, or like you said, like a ranking That's what it would be, like ranking people. It kind of felt like, well, that's a behavioral modification. So you would still kind of be like incentivizing people to behave a certain way if you're doing something positive. But those are things that we've socially deemed as like, this is positive, right? We're, you know, picking up litter as opposed to doing something negative. So, so it's like just, it's incentivizing behavior, but in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If I can add, like, I think there is also like two problems with that I see. One is how, like you said, like how it creates feedback loop, because let's say if you see someone's score being low and maybe they're having a, you know, really bad month, and then you would treat that person in the same way, thus locking them up in that cage. And I feel like it would create the same lockup if you have high scores as well. And then the second problem I see is there would always be some AI involved in this. And AI, as we have it, is not equitable towards everyone, because how we teach is how AI continues to operate. So, you know, the biases that we have in our own society and our own relationships, unfortunately, is reflected towards AI and how AI sees the world. And that is also like a huge problem that we need to think about more and make sure that we address. And of course, there are so many amazing people who are working on it, but I think that's also something that we should just be mindful of.
Do you think, when you talk about that, I thought about that prison experiment. You probably know more than I do, on like the psychology front, but when people are placed in like certain situations, they might have a tendency to like act a different way or like feel more superior, which then would make them act in a way that maybe they wouldn't have otherwise. And I had made a joke on Twitter like 2 days ago about like turtlenecks, because I wear a lot of turtlenecks, but I was like, what is it about wearing a turtleneck for it was a joke, but like for people, when immediately you put it on and you're like, oh, I'm a professional, or I'm like, you know, whatever. And it's like those little things, like really, it's on a personal level, you would have to assess, like, how am I feeling? Why am I behaving this way? Why do people rank people immediately when we see people? Like, you know, we can't deny that that doesn't happen, like judging people immediately. And how do we move past that? I think that's something that Robert Greene has also talked about, like how everybody has a tendency to automatically judge. And if you can actually like remove that and start to see beyond and really see the person, you're going to have a much better interaction with them. And you're going to build a relationship, and you're also going to be less prone to being manipulated by that person if they were to be malevolent for some reason. But yeah, what do you think about that? Like this immediate, if there was a ranking system, and I will move on from this topic, but I find it's kind of fascinating to me. Like if there was a ranking system, I could see like immediately people would start to just behave differently towards people that were, you know, ranked lower, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we see it today too, don't we? If you see someone who is homeless on the street, you don't act the same way that you would if you're in a coffee shop and asking something from a barista. And that's different if you're in a high-end restaurant and talking to the waiter, versus if you're in the same restaurant and you're talking to like someone else who's having dinner there. So I think we already have that. So numeralizing the situation sounds extremely scary to me.
Yeah. I'm glad you said that though, because I have been like, as soon as I heard somebody like was talking about the fact that they're, were trying to like work on something like that, I've been bringing it up everywhere just to see how people react to it, what their thoughts are. And I have, you know, I'm happy to hear that most of the time, their reactions are, yeah, I don't like that at all. I think that sounds, negative and ridiculous to have that, but I guess we'll see. I wrote down some other ethical like questions that I just wanted to ask about. So The one was just like transparency, because I think a lot of people think about blockchain and they kind of say, oh, well, I can do whatever I want because there's anonymity, but they don't realize that if you're on a public decentralized blockchain, like everything is transparent and it's quite easy to actually, you know, follow the steps and see what you're doing. So what are your thoughts on like public decentralized blockchains and also like data collection and how, I guess, you know, going full circle back to what we first started talking about, like how would you give advice to people on protecting their own private data as opposed to kind of like, you know, freely giving away even to Web3 companies that are going to come in and want to scoop it up?
I think that's a great question. In terms of transparency, I think how people think that what they do is not up there for everyone to see is such a hoax, because like you said, everything is so transparent on the blockchain. And yes, you might have a wallet that doesn't have your name on it, but essentially if you're going to put a money there or take money out of from there at some point, you can definitely 100% trace it. And I think this is more positive than negative, because in different industries like art market, for example, there has never been so such clarity and transparency about prices, about who owns what. So that offers amazing insight into what we do. So I think that's like the great part about transparency. Decentralization, in a sense, I think it's so important, and hopefully the Web3 that we're going to build, that's the utopia, that's the hope that we have. I think along the steps to get there, we're going to have different projects that are Web 2.2, Web 2.5, just to be realistic in terms of what practices that we're going to have to keep from Web 2 and which ones that we want to let go of in a new generation, new iteration of web. And how, in terms of how to protect your own data, I think learning about it is one of the main things. Just having more knowledge about how much data is being tracked, how much are you being watched, and that new Apple privacy feature hopefully helps. I don't know the inner workings of that, but I would believe that it helps a bit, because the ad revenues of companies like Snapchat and Facebook have gone declined since that update. So having knowledge on those
issues. Could you actually go back a little bit and just what is the Apple update? I think maybe I missed something. Could you explain what happened?
Of course. I think earlier this year, they had a new iOS update, which gives more security. And if you download a new app or log into an app for the first time, it asks, something pops up that asks you, do you want to ask the app not to track your data? And you can say, ask app not to track. The inner workings of that, I'm not 100% okay. Sure. I'm not sure if it's even public in that sense, but it is. The reason Apple wanted to do it was, I think, about like ad revenue. I'm sure they have a good and a self-serving purpose in creating this new update, but the different apps, for example, Snapchat, Facebook, their revenues did drop after that, ad revenues, and I know those apps weren't happy about this update.
Yeah, now that you say that, I have downloaded an app and I have been asked that question, but I honestly didn't even think about it. And this is terrible to say, especially for somebody like on this podcast, but if I download an app, I usually just press like, okay. But the more that I have personally been learning, the more I kind of, I have like multiple email addresses, and things like that. So, I try to do a little bit of different things, but I mean, I've already pressed yes to multiple apps to probably track my data, as well as I'm sure when you go into the app settings, if you haven't pressed no, they're accessing my microphone and stuff like that. So maybe I'll have to go look at my iPhone after this.
Yeah, I think tangibly that's a great idea. If an app doesn't need your location or a microphone, you can turn that off. Like if you use Instagram, then it might be difficult because every time you want to take a story, that's not going to let you, etc. But you could 100% dive more deep into what you need for each app. And especially for location, you can say, you know, track only while I'm using. That could make more sense for maybe like Postmates and Uber, etc. But yeah, you can be, people definitely should be more mindful about it.
And I wanted to kind of get into like the ethics around community, because, you know, when we're talking about like, you know, the Web3 space, everybody's talking about community. And do you see any like ethical concerns of like people wanting to build community only for the purpose of selling something and not really wanting to build a community? Do you think everyone should build a community? I think sometimes throughout history, we've seen people build communities that turn into something else, and it's like a totalitarian structure almost. Like, what are your concerns? Do you have any concerns about community building as we move into Web3?
This is such an amazing question that I never heard before, by the way. I love this question. I am seeing like two tiers of this right now. So one aspect is what you focus more on. If the people who are building these communities, are they in the position to be able to take on such a task? And do they have the best intentions in mind? And I think there are definitely great communities out there, but more of them, or more leaders of these projects, I believe, are focused on financial gains and self-serving financial gains. So in that sense, of course, there's an issue, which brings the responsibility more onto the user, which I guess is, you know, kind of the ethos and hope of Web3. You know, you have more power over your own money and your own assets. So you should know more about how these works, because you are responsible in buying into anything or selling your NFTs. So I think in that sense, it's an important question to have, and that brings the responsibility into users to research who is behind a project. And I personally have been mainly looking into the artists and the team in buying projects, because I believe that's a better approach for me for long-term holding. Just because it's good to think of NFT projects as a startup rather than, you know, the project ends with mint. No, the project actually starts with the minting day. And the second tier I see is also a topic that I like to talk about a lot, which is about representation. And if in these spaces that we're creating, if that's inviting to women, if it's inviting to Black people, LGBTQ, people from other underrepresented communities. And I actually just listened to something that was very interesting, and how it talked about the crypto culture, unfortunately not coming from the ethos that where we want to go, but how it's coming from the more bro-y culture and the 4chan culture, and how internet culture evolved from there to where we are in the crypto Twitter that we use. It was with the interview that the Defiant had with Ryder Rips, and that actually was super interesting to me, because unfortunately, regardless of how much work we put into where a culture of a community comes from, they'll have ripple effects, and we 100% see this with how much of the space is being bombarded by only male voices, which I like to speak out about a lot, because even if you're holding a Twitter space, it's for 1,000 people, and if 80% of the people are men, 20% are women, if you're still having all men on your panel as speakers, or if you even reflect that percentage into the speakers, I don't think that's cut out. That works. I think you need to have 50-50 representation, or at least strive to be. Because if you don't do that, then you're not going to have 50-50 listeners. Like, you can't expect listeners to come to you. You need to, like, as people in Web3, we need to go to places where these underrepresented groups of people are. Because where we are, it might not be the place that they think of to go. They might not think of to look for a specific job in that area. So we need to be proactive in bringing these people in. And I always say, you can't just be not racist or not sexist. You need to be anti-racist and anti-sexist, because when you think of the scale, there are so many people on the other side. I personally want to be more on the edge, just so I can try to balance that. And oh, something else too. Sorry. And it's so important to have people, women and people from underrepresented groups, in positions of power, especially, just so we can have ripple effect in all levels, because we also see that in C-suite levels, there are much fewer females always. So we just need to create that ripple effect and, like, build a web that's better and built for the people who are actually going to use it.
Yes, you read my mind there, because that's what I was going to ask about, like, I've seen this in other communities too, like in the book community, on Book Talk, or like on Bookstagram. I'm big into the book places. But most people, like, for different genres, you can really see it, where, especially for like nonfiction, for some reason, even though there's multiple books, and maybe the subcategory is flooded with female authors, or other authors that are like LGBTQ, but aren't strictly male, they don't get lifted up. And there's like a few male voices that have written a book, and even if it's like a 20-year-old book, it gets lifted up to the pinnacles of, this is like the authority on this topic, when there's so many new voices coming in that still aren't being lifted up for some reason. So I kind of can see that in other communities too. And it's just something interesting to note, I guess. And I think one of the best things to do is to actually like talk about it. And I've been actually really interested in like, how are people using this technology to gain power, and individual power, and from places where maybe they have felt powerless before, coming in from maybe like a place of having no financial freedom, not really understanding how to get financial freedom. And this could have been like pushback from generations. And how now, coming into Web3, learning about cryptocurrency, are they gaining financial freedom? Because I know for me, I didn't really understand how money worked until I started learning about cryptocurrency, and it forced me to learn about the monetary system. But yeah, I'm just really interested in like, how is technology helping people who didn't otherwise have power gain power and try to level the playing field of some sort?
Yeah, I mean, that's the post-colonial Western idealism, right? The Western medicine is seen as the correct one, and the one that's been used for thousands of years, and let's say like India is like alternative medicine, just because it doesn't fall in line with the white Western, you know, European view of the world. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's true. You know, something being dominant, something being more used, does not bring truthfulness. That's not a metric for truth. That just means that it is being used most often. So I think that's like a part of it, why that just comes along often. And I guess that also reminds me of an essay called, I believe it's called, "That Why Are There No Great Female Artists?" And it talks about how, you know, the greats are always men. You wouldn't really see, you know, women as put in as greats. And in that article, it actually talks about such great things about, you know, opportunity, about how women who could become these artists either had their father or their husbands as artists, and that gave them the opportunity. And if you think about it, women have been voting for what, like 100 years? And we have been on this earth for however many thousands of years. So if you think about it, like how little opportunity women has been presented in the history of the world. So I think just like being conscious of that and understanding where we come from and our history, and actively fighting against these urges and these inclinations of choosing the male to lead the project, or choosing the guy to, you know, act as the leader. That even comes into play, you know, women are much more likely to say yes, because they feel like if they say no, then they won't be asked again to do something. Like little workings like this, which I am seeing more and more so since I started, you know, working after graduating and just being more mindful. The more you pay attention, the more you see, for sure. And that's just not true. There are so many number ones in the world who are women or from other underrepresented groups, and they just need to be given a chance and be trusted.
Yeah, I think I like, I was look thinking back to like times in my existence of like working in Web3, and you know, sometimes feeling that, and I wanted to go back a little bit and just touch on something that you had said about building communities for the sole purpose of selling. I know for me, I'm not going to mention the project, but I worked on a project one time. I was asked to like come in on a project and help out. And I just remember I asked like so many times, okay, but what is this for? Like, what is this NFT actually for? Who is it for? And what are they actually going to get out of it? And I, after like 3 weeks, I couldn't determine what the people were actually going to get out of buying it. And I had to say, I'm sorry, I can't continue on the project, because there was no clear exchange. And I thought, this is just useless. This is nothing. We're creating something for no reason other than to get people's finances. And yeah, it just, as a personal thing, it just did not feel right for me. And I remember I asked so many times, because I thought maybe they just weren't thinking about it in the right way. And that led me to wondering, like, how often does that happen? And really trying to, like, when I go to look at NFT projects, look a little bit deeper into them to determine whether it's something that I even want to be a part of. And usually I'll hang out in Discords for like weeks at a time. I'll ask questions. I'll talk to other people who aren't in the team, but they're part of the community. Those are just different things that I've started to do since having that experience, which was a little more early on of me kind of like starting to work in Web3. But it does happen. Yeah, it does happen.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure it all happens a lot more often than you would want to see.
Yeah. Yeah, so I also wanted to, I had written down that, so smart contracts and writing like rules or writing laws that are self-executing is something that I think is fascinating. So we saw like a hacker being sent an NFT restraining order. And I wondered, like, how far-reaching does that go? I was kind of listening to a talk about smart contracts might have implications in politics. And, of course, like, blockchain voting for being able to vote and keep track of that data while also having your privacy, so not giving up, anonymity in that sense. But how far do you think that really goes? And with predictability algorithms, do you think, like, okay, this might be a silly question, but do you think it could ever get to the point where it's like that movie Minority Report?
I haven't seen the movie.
Okay.
But I think...
Basically, they're, like, predicting whether somebody's going to commit a crime or not.
Okay, okay. I think I saw a clip of that, actually. yeah. So, I think, like... blockchain, DAOs, voting, all that brings such great human coordination that we never had before, right? And it actually gives us equal voices, ability to participate in the, where a platform goes or where a project goes, which is amazing and 100% will have long-term implications. And I think we're still figuring out how to give people the incentive, give people the rewards of participating, and sort of, I think the problem with DAOs usually is like creating the core of that, because also there are so many projects, DAOs, etc. People want to participate in as many as them possible, but realistically, what I'm seeing as well is, I mean, I had like my share of, you know, bad NFT purchases as well, not researching much, and then just I should get this, and then doesn't go well, but. So, and then now I'm realizing, just because it's so difficult to keep track of everything, and I'm not a big fan of Discord either, you can like legitimately be a part of or track very few number of projects / participate in DAOs. So I think like in that sense, that's amazing. And for smart contracts, how I usually like to see it is, it's a code, right? So how I see it is more of a, perhaps for transactional issues, if you are selling a house, perhaps you have that code and the smart contract that will be executed. So you don't need that third party to put the escrow and the money, put the house and the money into escrow, but you can actually have the smart contract do it for you. So I think like smart contract lawyers and interpreters and people who just, you know, create these will be important, and that will become more of a job in the future. So I really see use cases in smart contracts, but I don't see it happening in terms of perhaps like law in the next 5 years, just because the inner workings of that and it being more accepted, I think would take longer than that. And in terms of the predictability algorithms that you were talking about and the movie, maybe probably shouldn't do that, just because coming back to the topic that we talked about in terms of AI bias, if you want to predict someone, causing a crime, you're taking away free will, essentially, right? You are labeling someone in making a decision before they make it. I'm actually really interested in neuroethics, which is ethics of neuroscience and neuroscience of ethics. And this topic was discussed there, you know, in that realm of study, because you could potentially identify brain areas and brain deformities that could lead someone into being more violent, or someone has an injury that makes them, you know, completely change their character and perhaps blocks the empathy part of their brain. Like, these are all possibilities that happened before in history. But even in that sense, even if you know that someone has that, like, can you still lock them up? Can you still you shouldn't be able to prosecute them for a crime that they didn't commit yet, but do you still have a responsibility to monitor that or make sure you avoid it? That's a loaded question, and I don't think I am, you know, the best authority in terms of replying to that. But personally, that doesn't sit too right with me. But I know it's probably like there are more nuances that you would need to get into.
Yeah, I think, definitely more nuance. And I don't personally have the answer. Something that I have to think about a lot. I don't even know if I'd want to be the person in charge of making a decision like that at all. But I definitely agree that it would be encroaching on individual freedom. And I really liked the quote that freedom is really predicated on privacy. If you don't have privacy, you technically don't have freedom. And that's kind of like been a baseline of me thinking about Web3, blockchain, and kind of like maneuvering in a world where a lot of what we're doing and have been doing in Web2, obviously with our, data being tracked, is transparent. And again, I don't have the answers, but it's really interesting to think about and try to educate myself on and hopefully give some people some resources as to where I find different information. One last question I did have was, when you were talking about DAOs, have you found any like unique DAO structures? I've only found one where the founder role was completely removed, and actually they had to go to their lawyer. Their lawyer advised them not to remove the founder role, and they kept pressing it, and they finally got the founder role removed. That to me, I was like, okay, that's like a whole other step in really becoming decentralized by taking that end decision maker away to where it really does become like we have to vote and we have to find a way to agree on something. Have you found any like unique DAO structures or anything that you find interesting in that space?
I think there are a lot of DAOs who are experimenting with interesting things. And a lot of tools that help DAOs, do voting or certain decision makings or reward mechanisms. I actually have a article about, 10 DAO tools that people mainly use and like to, they utilize. I can't think of like something too specific in terms of this is being done, but as a general rule, not pointing to a certain DAO, I think having really great incentive mechanisms and rewarding mechanisms is important, because you don't want people to do a lot of work and don't feel like they are seen within the community, because essentially there are stuff that needs to be done within that DAO. And I also think you definitely need certain couple of people who are not necessarily maybe like full time, but has the DAO as like their main thing, one of their main things. Because I think you need, maybe you don't need a driver, maybe you don't need a CEO, but I think you need someone to make sure that the DAO doesn't die off, because I feel like we also see that within our little Web3 bubble. Sorry.
Yeah, I actually had written down like that idea in Web3. For some reason, there's this idea that if you fail, then you failed completely and you can't come back. And I think it's the idea of that is like for NFT projects, right? If you put an NFT project out and it fails, then everybody thinks that you're done, you failed, it was just a ripoff. Or if people bought an NFT from you and it doesn't immediately increase in value, they think that they got ripped off. And I think that's one of the more negative mental shifts in terms of Web3 that I see, is more people not really thinking about like what you said earlier, you know, the mint is like the beginning of the project itself, and you have a long ways to go to build what you're trying to build. And do you think that there's a shift that could happen there too, or like that we do need a mental shift in terms of like, why do so many people think that if it doesn't immediately skyrocket in price, or, you know, people don't sell out their projects, that it's a failure and they have to quit and just leave the space?
That is a very detrimental mindset for sure. And unfortunately, for many, many months, the NFT hype culture operated in that system. You needed a project to sell out in 2 minutes if you wanted to be successful. That was the whole premise of last fall, I believe. And I've been in NFTs about a year and a half now, so I could, you know, see the ups and downs, and whenever something that changed the whole vibe, you know, like loot was definitely one example of that. It changed how people looked at NFTs. And now and then Goblin Town did the same months after. So when you buy art, that was also one of like a big conversation a couple months ago, where people are, you know, when utility. It's, I think, 100% fair for people to ask for, like, if I'm buying into an NFT paying thousands of dollars, yes, I would want to have a free t-shirt maybe. But if you're especially buying art from an artist in the shape of, in the form of NFT, then you shouldn't really expect utility unless it's previously, you know, disclosed or mentioned, because you don't really need something else, utility, if you buy a art to put up to your wall in real life. So I think that's a aspect to think for sure. And also, hopefully during this bear markets, we're gonna focus more on building rather than everything mooning. I've definitely been, you know, kind of been the other side of that, with buying something and then expecting it to go up and then it doesn't. Or I, you know, got into that hype culture because that's, you know, I write a newsletter enough times, so I have to report on the what happens. So I try to participate and set up as much as I can. But my hope for this time and what I'm trying to do is not focusing on the hype culture, but the technology itself. The NFT is such a powerful technology that goes beyond collectibles and beyond PFPs. So focusing on that, focusing on different ways we can utilize blockchain, focusing on understanding decentralization, peer-to-peer ecosystems, understanding perhaps how DeFi and DAOs and social tokens and NFTs play with one another, you know, same with smart contracts and mining and minting. And hopefully we will create something that is less about hype and more about collective building. But I also think we shouldn't label NFTs and, you know, the crazy market on the side being, this is, you know, not what we want. Because if you think of the 2000s Web2 boom, there always will be bad actors trying to profit off of a hyped situation. I don't think that has any innate negative situation in that. It's just kind of how it is. There will be bad players, there will be short-term players, but there are also a lot of amazing, amazing people building such cool products with the technology that we have. So I think the bear market is probably going to show us those people more so. Because people who build, they're not necessarily the loudest people in the room or, you know, on Twitter. No, I agree. If NFT is supposed to be art, it can just be art. If it's supposed to be an access token, it can be that. It can be a membership card. It can be a 3D object. It can be a metaverse wearable. It can be a music or a royalty from a music. Like, the possibilities are so endless with each of the industries that, I like to cover and read about and write about. So, I mean, the future is exciting. We just need to make sure that we make the right decisions for the right people. Course. So my newsletter is NF Times. I've been publishing it for more than a year, which is crazy. But I write about weekly NFT news, metaverse, gaming, sports, music, fashion, kind of covering what happens in all these industries. And you can find it at nftimes.substack.com or NF underscore times on Twitter. And you can find me on Elena underscore ETH on Twitter as well. And you can reach out to me with any questions, any thoughts, or come on to, I have a weekly Twitter Spaces with Wearable with head of community there that we speak every Monday about weekly news, and we bring people on to chat last 15 minutes. So I would love to chat with you there.
Thanks for listening to Blockchain for Beginners podcast. As a reminder, you can join our Discord group where you can vote on upcoming episodes, ask questions to guests, and more. If you enjoyed this episode and the podcast in general, be sure to give us a like and a rating on the podcast platform that you're listening. Thanks so much for your continued support.